Thank you. Thank you very much. My presentation is Riding Your Way Out of the Mormon Mirage. That's actually just a little bit of a play on words on this book, The Mormon Mirage, which I wrote starting in 1979. But I was very interested with the presentations this morning about the origins of the Book of Mormon and about who might have wrote it. Might have written it. I'm a good writer. Now, I brought this Book of Mormon with me from the room, the hotel room here.
Was that the very same one that Hiram?
No, but I am going to definitively answer the question that Mormon missionaries always ask after they read a few passages out of this and they present it to a prospective convert saying, could any man have written this book? And I'm here to tell you that I think a woman would have done a better job. How good the history of the Mormon Church would have been if Emma had done it. I'm very note dependent. I apologize for that. But if you want me to stay on topic, then I'm going to have to do that. I'm going to give you a little outline of what we're going to cover today. I'm going to tell you a little bit, as Sue requested, about how I came to be a Mormon and why I left the Mormon Church. A little bit about what I did at Brigham Young University when I was there, about the writing that I do now, and I'll just tell you that up until this book was re-released this year and then my first novel came out, I had not written about Mormonism for like 12 years, 15 years. I'm one of those people that could leave Mormonism, and I did leave it alone for quite a long time. And I spent the last long time honing the craft of writing. And one of the ways I did that was I was hired by a website that was partially owned by CBS. And I was called Office.com. It was right during the big .com surge. And I was hired to write articles, as many as 5 a week, and if any of you are journalists, you'll realize what I'm talking about, in which I had to have 2 original interviewed subjects per article, and they were on the subject of utilities, gas, electric, sewer, nuclear, and I think the other was environmental services. And so when I talk to you about writing, there are different ways to hone your craft as a writer. In doing that, I learned, and in writing for military magazines also, which is what I've written for mainly recently, you learn to be accurate, you learn to document, and you learn that you have no control over who reads it, only how you write it, and how you convince your editor to let it remain that way. What I'm going to be talking about to you today are types of writing, and I think that for this audience, and I've really carefully considered what your needs might be, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about writing short fiction and long fiction, about writing nonfiction, and why, and I kind of suspect that most of you are interested in writing your stories, which is nonfiction, but more specifically as memoir. And each of these categories is going to take a little bit of a different approach, and so I'm going to try to talk to you about that. And then at the end, we have a sheet that is passed out. Do you all have a sheet already that's been passed out? It's being passed around. I'm going to go over that list with you, and then I'm going to give you some recommendations for marketing your own writing. But before I start telling you about my story of in Mormonism, I want to ask you, has anyone else in this room dated a general authority? Someone who's now a general authority? Because I did. Bruce Porter, who is one of the council of the, how do you say it now? I've even forgotten the term. The 70, he said, first council of the 70, was my boyfriend at BYU at the time that I left Mormonism. And so that's kind of an interesting twist. I don't know whether I'm bragging or apologizing. Yes, and I have been reminded of that various times. I became a Mormon for one reason only. There was some ancillary motivation, but I thought it was a way to please God. And I think that for people who are converted to Mormonism, which, as you know, it's a different mindset than people who are born in the church, It's a mistake to assume that people have motives other than that. It's always best to start with that motive. I was 11 years old, and I'd always had a great interest in ancient things, in the American Indians. I grew up near the Indian reservations in New Mexico. That's why I'm wearing this jewelry. I remember as a child begging my parents to please drop me off at the reservation and let me live in a hogan. And I could not understand why they would not do that for me. So when my father brought these missionaries to our home who had scriptures that were based on ancient Egyptian writings, which I was very interested in Egyptology, and could explain the plight and the history of the Native Americans, and could tell me of a plan of salvation where nobody had to go to hell, where everybody had a second chance, a merciful gospel. I thought it was just wonderful, and I embraced it fully and wholly, and was just very happy at doing it. I did baptisms for the dead as a youth. Do they still put kids on buses and haul them off to temples and let them do baptismal trips? Yeah, I did that. But what I didn't realize until later was some of my dad's motivations. And I've never spoken about this publicly, and so you're the first to hear this. But my dad was a 32nd degree Mason, and he was worshipful master of a lodge. And it was only much later, and in fact, now after reading Dan Brown's book, The Lost Symbol, have any of you read that? Do you notice how many things, even though it only mentions the Mormon Church twice in it, or Joseph Smith, how many things are in there are just spot-on Mormonism. I couldn't believe it. But anyway, my dad had an interest in the Masonic handshakes, rituals, and that sort of thing. And he also was very interested in polygamy, I learned later, because he had a mistress. And so he had his own motivations for becoming a Mormon. My mom was not impressed. She called them the Ku Klux Mormons and never was willing to join up. But through my youth, the Mormon Church was a wonderful influence on me. I had a very unstable home life. My father became very ill and nearly died. There was a subsequent divorce. My mother remarried. But through all that, the Mormon Church was solid and helpful to me. So when I got a scholarship, a writing scholarship, to go to BYU, I don't know if they still have those. They call them the Arab Youth Writing Contest. I used to be able to get scholarships to go to BYU, and that's how I was able to go. And it was there that I continued dating Bruce Porter, the general authority, who was from my hometown of Albuquerque, and was just so happy. And I was looking at my BYU yearbook and thinking about this recently. Not only is Bruce's picture in there, but Paul Toscano, Margaret Toscano's husband, he was my editor on the school magazine that I wrote for. Deborah Legler, who you may know as Deborah Lake, who wrote Secret Ceremonies, was on staff with me. Mitt Romney was actually there. And so I bought into this and just loved it so much. And I had a temple recommend while I was there, and my third summer after my sophomore or my junior year at BYU, I went back to Albuquerque to work. The first two summers I drove an Apostolical truck to make up the other money to get to go to college. And I went back and I was working as a waitress, and my mom, who played honky-tonk piano at a pizza joint, kept telling me about this young man that she'd met who was from Tennessee, and she was from Tennessee. I was not interested in him, but we finally did meet, and he was waiting for someone back in Tennessee. I was waiting for Bruce Porter, who was on a mission to Germany, and I was going to, I think in German, I'd gotten a minor in German at BYU, because when he got off the plane from his mission, I was going to speak German to him. But when he got off his plane from his mission, I was engaged to someone else. That was a different kind of surprise. But but during that time, I had not had any doubts. There had only been two times when anything had ever rippled across my consciousness that made me doubt Mormonism. One of them was a little green and white pamphlet, which I can still see in my mind's eye, called Mormon Claims Examined by Larry Jonas. It probably came out in the 50s or 60s. And I remember seeing that pamphlet and thinking, this could not possibly be true. These things about the American Indians and the Book of Mormon, this couldn't be true. And so I stuffed it. And then I lived off campus my last year at BYU, and somebody put pamphlets all around the houses there around BYU. And they were from this crazy couple in Salt Lake City that were polygamists and they were immoral, and that's why they were trying to destroy our faith. Gerald and Sandra Tanner. And so I took the advice of my roommates, and I didn't even read the pamphlets because I didn't want my faith destroyed. So when I met this young man, Dan Scott, who promised to study the Mormonism, because I had converted a lot of people to Mormonism at my time at BYU. I hadn't gone on a mission, but I'd been a resident assistant in Helaman Hall's dorms and had converted many of the girls that had come as non-Mormons. But what I found was that not only did Mormonism not square with the Bible that he was teaching me, but it didn't square with itself. And that was extremely disturbing to me. And it did not square with the history or the archaeology, any of the sciences of the world. My point of separation, and everybody, I think, has their point of departure from Mormonism, that mental point where everything snaps, where it may have been kind of building, was actually a Pearl of Great Price woodcut. I was so angry with this Dan Scott for trying to damage my faith that I had made arrangements to leave Albuquerque early for that summer, go back to Virginia University where I was helping Dr. Lyman Sid Shreve do a Spanish workbook on the gauchos. And I thought, I'm just going to get away from this. I can't handle this. And I was sitting on my couch with my bags packed, looking at my favorite book of scripture, which was the Doctrine and Covenants and the Pearl of Great Price. And I opened it up to the woodcut where Joseph Smith had identified as Prince Pharaoh, someone who had obviously dressed as a woman. Does that mean anything to anybody else? People often ask me, why did you leave Mormonism? And I say the point of departure was looking at that woodcut because it was not an anti-Mormon book. It was my own book of scripture that I had. And why I'd never seen it before, I have no explanation for that. But I saw that, and then everything started cascading. Well, I went back to BYU for about, I guess, maybe 5 or 6 weeks because I thought I could go back and nobody would notice, right? And so people would come up and slug me on the shoulder and say, how's your testimony? And I'd say, you know, boy, what a beautiful fall day, you know, that sort of thing. And so it started getting around. My bishop called me in, and he was a new bishop for the ward there at BYU, and he asked me what kind of job I'd like to have. And of course, I had taught, you know, classes, Relief Society classes. And I said, well, I'd like to be on cleanup. You know, I'd like to clean up after activities. And he thought I was just being humble, but I really didn't want to have anything to do with doctor. Then when the Mormon prophet was there at BYU and everybody stood and saying, we think we feel God for a prophet, I thought I was going to die. I thought right then that my heart was going to stop. Well, the books that I had been reading mainly were kind, gentle books about Mormonism. And I say that because they had a sympathetic attitude toward Mormons. And that has stayed with me through all of this because one thing that people say about my own writing is that I'm not bitter, and I'm not. And I'm not, I try not to be inflammatory, but if I am, it's not on purpose. But then I came across what was described this morning as a comb-bound phone book, Mormonism, Shadow, or Reality. And I had been married about 3 months and started reading that book, and it was just like what I imagine being addicted to pornography must be like, because it was so forbidden and so luscious. just because what I was reading there caused me to lose my faith in Mormonism did not mean that what I was being offered as a substitute was legitimate. And I say that because I realize that many of you do not have a religious faith, and I don't want to give you the impression that I just jumped from one thing into another. In this new edition of the Mormon Mirage, I described that it was 10 years before I began to have any sort of emotional stability about Mormonism. And I say that, too, not to make you feel sorry for me, but I know many of you are early on in this journey, and it will be all right. If you just stay true to truth, it'll be all right, but it will be rocky. If you cared about it, and I did, I loved Mormonism so much. It was also 5 years before I met another ex-Mormon Christian, anybody like me. Just imagine if you went the first 5 years like this and did not ever see in the flesh anybody who had the same thing that you had. It was a very emotional experience. I'm not the huggy kissy type. This poor man, you know, was hugging me like this because I was, you know, weeping in his arms just to have flesh contact with a real person like me. It was during that time that I started working on this book, The Mormon Mirage. I started working on it when I was 24 years old. I'm not going to give you the details about that until a little bit later because I want to tell you a few things that happened as I was writing it. As I was writing it, I corresponded with a lot of people in a group called Ex-Mormons for Jesus, and that was the very first support groups that I know of, and they were Christian-based support groups for people who were coming out of Mormonism. And I actually wrote to several of the chapters, and I told them that I was preparing this book called The Mormon Mirage, and that I wanted some testimonies from people who were coming out. During that time, there was a man named Stan Fields, or Stephen Mayfield, who was employed at the church office building. Now, I can't document that he was employed by the church, but he was infiltrating these groups. And as he was infiltrating these groups, he was reporting back this kind of information. And so when this book started to come out, I had been an active member of a Christian church in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which was my hometown where I'd grown up as a Mormon. And yet nobody had ever done anything. Nobody had ever come to see me, ask me any questions or anything else. And I thought, well, you know, it's time now to become excommunicated from the Mormon church. I need to do that, you know. And so I called a man who was my bishop. He was not the bishop of the ward when I was a Mormon, but he was now the bishop of the ward in which I was. And I called him and I said, well, first I wrote a letter, and I said, I want to be excommunicated from the Mormon church on the basis of apostasy. And I want it in writing, and I will not attend a bishop's court, because as you know, I don't know how it is now, but at that time, a woman could not go into a bishop's court with another woman. You could only, the only people you could take with you are priesthood holders. So what am I going to do? You know, I didn't have a priesthood holder, and I didn't want one to accompany me. So I said, I want this done, and I want it in writing, and if you do not give me in writing that I have been excommunicated from the Mormon church at my own request on the basis of apostasy, I'm going to publish it in the newspaper. Well, that got some results. And I got a call from this bishop, and he said, you know, Sister Scott, we're having a problem processing your excommunication. And I said, what's that? He says, we don't have any records that you've ever been a member of the Mormon church. So I start adding up in my mind, and I realize that that Mormon missionaries who had parked outside the front of my house when my husband was gone during the day with their Book of Mormon on the dashboard and their name tags. I'm not, you know, witnessed by many people. That they knew I was writing the book. I thought I was being so slick that nobody knew, you know, except other ex-Mormons. Well, Stan Mayfield apparently was reporting that. And they thought that the way that they would perhaps dilute the effectiveness of this book is to be able to say, well, you know, she never was a Mormon. And he said to me, you don't happen to have any proof, do you? And I said, well, what kind of proof do you want? And he said, well, you don't happen to have your baptismal certificate. I said, well, yes, I do. And he was crestfallen. And he said, would you read me the names of the elders who baptized and confirmed you? I said, yes. I said, do you want to see a copy of the temple recommend or anything like that? He says, no, that'll be good enough. I say that because if you think about doing anything publicly with your history as a Mormon, I really urge you to keep your documents. Mine are in a safe deposit box. You never know when you might need the proof of the fact that you were a Mormon. And when we think about how history is revised, you know, a generation from now, if you want people to know why you made the decisions you made, you need to be able to prove that you were a Mormon. Well, the LDS Church comes to my website on a regular basis. I have a stat counter where I can see that, so I know they're still watching. And during that time also, I met a woman named Gloria Pace, who was had been a faithful Mormon in Albuquerque. And she had been assigned the job of taking Mormon missionaries in Albuquerque around to the public libraries and having them check out all the anti-Mormon books until they went out of print, and then they would say they were so sorry they lost them and pay for them, but of course, when the book's out of print, you can't get another one. And that was one of her jobs that she was assigned to do, and I thought, God, this is crazy. Well, she began having some doubts also, and when Gloria left the Mormon church, she asked to be excommunicated. but she didn't specify on what grounds, and was announced in a neighboring town in Los Lunas, New Mexico, in a Relief Society meeting that she had been excommunicated for adultery, which was not true at all. So again, if you're going to ask for excommunication or resign, make it specific and make sure that more than one person knows what you're doing. Make sure that, you know, letters go out to various people so that it can't be just in one hand. But I am very grateful to him for having been a Mormon for many, many reasons. One was the stability during my teenage years, and another is because it launched my writing career. That was a joke. Now, I'm going to, for the rest of our time together, give you some very practical hints about how to get your work published, if not get it published, about how to write effectively. So we're going to kind of squeeze into what remains of this hour what I teach an entire semester on when I teach it. But we're going to talk about writing effectively first, and then I'll talk to you about how to get your work published or how to get it in front of people who are likely to publish it. But I have to tell you ahead of time, this is not the way I did it. And I'll explain that later. But I'm going to tell you what will work. First of all, you have to consider your audience. Who are you writing for? Are you writing just for yourself? And that's a very noble thing to do, because many of us cannot work through problems unless we write them down. Are you writing to a limited group, a focus group like your family? Are you thinking about providing a record for after you're gone about why you made the decisions you did? Or do you have a broader audience? Would you like to earn some money off your writing? Would you like to have some sort of a public acclaim? Whatever your audience that you're going for, you owe it to yourself to do the very best writing that you can do. If you're going to do it, as my mother would say, do it right. Also consider writing with what we call a behavioral objective. Now, that's a teaching term. That teacher gets up in front of a group, and they expect that because of what they tell them, the group is going to take to heart something and make some changes in their behaviors. What is your behavioral objective that you have in writing? In other words, when somebody picks up your book, your memoir, your letter, whatever it is that you're going to write, what do you want the reader to do in response to that? Now, for the Mormon Mirage, I wanted to explain in a comprehensive way the reasons why Mormonism could not stand as a viable belief system when compared with things inside and outside of itself. And I wanted the reader, when they got through, to say, yes, I can follow this logic, and I can document these things, and I can look up the footnotes for myself, and I can make a decision. I don't think anywhere in the book I demanded that anyone think the way I think. But I did provide enough information. Another thing you need to consider is, why will people want to read what you write? And there are only three reasons why someone wants to read somebody else's writing. One is because of who you are or who you know. Much of what's published in the United States of America is published by somebody because of who they are or who they know, not necessarily because they have something to say. The second thing is because you have something legitimate to say. You have, I got my PhD and had to write a dissertation, and the purpose of a dissertation is to provide information that has not been known before, to document something, to add to the body of knowledge. And so you should have the same goal. You should be able to say something or want to say something that either hasn't been said before or with a unique slant that only you can give. And the third reason, the first one is who you are, who you know. The second is what you have to say. And the third is how well you write. And those of you who enjoy reading sometimes read not because there's a great thought to a book, but just for the sheer pleasure of a good writer. I do need to say something. Charles mentioned something this morning about writing as a source of income, and he has done the very noble task of turning the profits from his book back into the ability to give it, his book, to other people. My husband refers to me as someone whose habits he supports. Even though I have published 15 books with major Christian publishing companies, most of them are major, a couple of them are minor, I've shown a loss on my personal or my corporate income all but 2 years in the last 20. And I say this because if you're going to put your time and your effort into this, it has to be for the worth of it alone. You have to believe in what you're doing, and it has to be worth it to you. And if you happen to make some money, hey, that's great, but that should not be your goal. Or if it is your goal, you're probably going to be disappointed in me. I should say that. One thing that people who are writing with a stance or a posture or, I don't want to say an agenda, but one thing that people have to do when they're writing persuasive writing is to remember that one of your goals is to answer the objections that the reader will have before they arise in the mind of the reader. So, as you're writing, you are going to try to anticipate every but that somebody reading it is going to have. And if you're writing something as controversial as materials about Mormonism, there might be many, many objections. So it doesn't hurt to, and if you've seen me any time this whole conference, I was carrying around 3x5 cards, write things down. Think role play. Think of how your audience, whether it's that limited audience, that focused audience, or that broad audience I was talking about before, what are the people, the real people with real faces in it, going to object to that you're saying, and then find out how to address their objections before they arise. That allows a reader to interact with you and keeps you from being bombastic, because it allows the reader to rise to the subject matter. Now, I have found, and I do not want to insult the intelligence of true blue Mormons, because I was myself one, but I found that in my experience that a true blue Mormon would argue with a sack of turnips if it fell off a Mormon truck. So you have to be willing to think about the objections that such a person would have. At my church, somebody asked me, and they were saying, you're a Christian, why are you going to a group that is mainly agnostic or atheist and teaching them how to write better? And I said, I am thrilled to do that, because if I am going to understand where you're coming from, you're going to have to articulate it. And I want you to be able to articulate what you're thinking, what you're feeling, and your reasons for what you believe or do not believe, so that I can interact with you. So that is my goal here. Where did you get the training to be a good writer? Obviously, I cannot do that today in a little over an hour. Take a class. Go to your community college. They have writing classes all the time. Go online and see if there aren't writers' communities with classes. Go to a senior citizen center, and many of you in here, like me, probably qualify for that. Go, and they offer classes on how to write effectively. Take a for credit class at a university. Buy a book. I had published 13 of my books before I started writing a novel, and all of my books and all of my writing had been nonfiction, with a couple of exceptions. I had written and published and won awards for poetry and some other things, radio plays. But this was really my first book of fiction, and I'm going to describe to you how I learned how to write a novel, and it was by taking classes. There was a person who offered a class on how to write an effective novel, and I took it. Admit what you don't know. You know, one of my great advantages has always been that I have been blonde, and people assume that I'm kind of stupid because I'm blonde. And I've always taken to heart and proof of this is that whenever I've been in large groups of people that do not know me, and someone says, you write books, what kind of books do you write? And my children would run behind that person, always mouth the word, oh, do you write children's books? Because they assume that you're blonde, you write children's books. And so I wrote and published one just so I could say, yes, you're absolutely right. But you know what Dolly Parton said about blonde jokes? She said, dumb blonde jokes. She said, dumb blonde jokes don't bother me. She says, first of all, I know I'm not dumb. And second of all, I know I'm not blonde. And neither am I. But anyway, admit what you don't know. And here's some things. I'm going to run through a list of things, and I hope if you only get one or two of these, that may stimulate your thinking, they will help you to be a better writer. One is, especially for people writing about Mormonism, avoid overstatement. It's always better to say something subtly, and you can go back and strengthen it, than it is to say something too harshly and try to back off. Does that make sense to you? Okay. Number two, consider the role of foul language. You have a perfect right to say or write whatever you want to. I'm not here to tell you to do that or not. But recognize that foul language or overstatement whittles down your audience, because there are many people that they read the first thing that is objectionable and they won't read the rest. Do you want your work to be read by the audience that you have in mind? Then consider their objections and try to meet them, especially with language. Take the advice of William Strunk. Strunk and White are one of your resources that I have on your sheet that was passed out there. It's something that every writer should have, because it is a guide to good writing. But here's what William Strunk said. Make definite assertions. Avoid tame, colorless, hesitating, noncommittal language. In other words, take a stand. Find the right language to say what you need to say. Number four, and this is probably the biggest one mistake made by beginning writers or people that want to get published, and that is they use too many passive verbs. Do you know what a passive verb is versus an active verb? An active verb is she vacuumed the carpet. A passive one is the carpet was vacuumed by the woman. Do you have an example?
Pregnant Monson. Famous for
its
passive verbs.
Were touched.
Live.
Were blessed. And people fell asleep. That's what happens with passive verbs. If it sounds like a government report, it sounds politically correct, you're making a big mistake. Don't do that. Another thing is a writing principle called show, don't tell. And to illustrate show, don't tell, I'm going to read you the very brief first chapter of Latter-day Cipher, and you tell me, without me having identified specifically what's going on here, you tell me what you learned when I showed you and did not tell you. There on the damp pine needles, Kirsten Young lay on her back, a serene Ophelia in her dusty pond of blood. The dark irises of her bloodshot eyes stared unseeing into the branches above her. The sun had burst through the clouds after the sudden downpour and now blazed above the canopy of conifers and aspens in Provo Canyon. Deep in its recesses, the light filtered down in vertical sheets of champagne dust that played across the body. Her skin, once the faintest of olive, was now as pale as churned cream, mottled in the dark pooling of what everyone called her hot Italian blood. An angry oval blue bruise, dark as a plum, marked the side of her forehead. The slit in her throat cut deep. Her left arm lay loosely at her side, still bearing at the wrist the friction marks from the plastic rope that had bound her. Her right arm crossed her chest, with the elbow supported by a rock underneath the triceps so the arm stayed in place. Her fingers curled slightly around her own shoulder, as if she gave herself a final hug in death. The tip of her tongue touched delicately the edge of the open wound under her left ear. The scene on the forest floor was meant to set things aright. No, no, she wasn't Ophelia at all, he thought. She was Eve, temptress and sinner cast from the Garden of Utah, wearing a hasty apron of cottonwood leaves, heaped around and across her plump belly, from just below the navel to mid-thigh. Tiny rivulets of blood snaked down through the leaves. The other four wounds, the little ones, were post-mortem, made after she'd already bled out. On the right side of her chest, incised with surgical precision, the first cut penetrated deep, a backward L. It depicted a carpenter square, the straight edge, true maker, indispensable for right angles. The desired angularity could not, alas, be achieved on the soft roundness of the still warm flesh. Nor could the second, the compass. On the left side, a chevron gaped open with edges that wanted to lose their definition, a tiny V on this day of defeats and victories. A third inch long slit carefully cut the muscle just above the knee that would never again bow. A final slit traversed her stomach just above the navel. A sign of nourishment for a body that would never again eat, of health for one who would only decay. They were all symbols only the initiated would understand. But below her navel mark, Kirsten harbored her own tiny secret, one that held the seed of her killer's downfall, her own unwitting fleshly vengeance. In the sheeting light, her murderer stood above her like the angel guarding Eden, his knife sword flashing this way and that in his gloved hands. He had brought along a white sheet he bought at a garage sale and kept stored in a plastic bag. But he changed his mind about putting it over her. She was beyond the veil now. His shoulders sagged beneath the once white jumpsuit. The leaves embroidered on the green cloth apron he wore were speckled as a measles plant. The X-Acto knife lay at his feet, and he picked it up and threw it and the sheet into the stream. Then he laid the note carefully on the ground, its edge secured by a rock. The white cap still contained his close-cropped hair that had lost its starched definition. It too sagged as he backed away from Kirsten, brushing over with a fallen pine branch the near invisible footprints they had both made when they came to this, his sacred grove. His breathing was heavy as he recited. They'd said it was the pure Adamic language he'd learned that time at age 19, scared half to death by all the temple vows and the disembodied voices behind the veils. Pele Ael. Pele Ael. Pele Ael. He swallowed hard. O Lord, hear the words of my mouth. What do you know that I didn't spell out for you there? The woman was murdered? Who has murdered her? Someone with a Mormon background who's been to the temple, who stood before the veil, and who is very interested in taking the symbols of the temple and putting them onto a body for some particular purpose. Well, you have to read the book to find out the rest. But that is an example, and I hope you will indulge me for using myself as an example, but that's an example of showing not telling. Another thing that is very, very important in writing is using what I call a controlling concept. And that is an image or a phrase or something that kind of acts as a rein or a border for what you're doing. Now, in that passage that I read to you from Latter-day Cipher, this was a man who's taking abstractions, which are symbols, and making them real onto a body. And the entire book is about the interchange, the interplay between what are called facts and representations. It's kind of a brainy book because I'm wanting people to think about the fact that those things that are symbolic in the temple have something behind them, and that you deal not just with the symbols but what's behind them, as you do with all of Mormonism. Now, that idea of a controlling concept can also be used in nonfiction. I showed you or demonstrated how that was used in fiction. I wrote a book about crisis. When our daughter was 8 years old, she had a malignant tumor that destroyed part of her skull. And then 3 years later, she fell and hit the other side of her head against a brick wall and had a close-head concussion while I was writing a book about the first experience. And my son came to me and he said, "Mom, you know, why do you think God is allowing these things to happen, you know, while you're writing a book about crisis?" And I said, "Well, I think maybe it's just on the job training." And he said, "Next time write a book about getting rich." But in that book, I described the second incident where she fell and hit her head against a brick wall and had the close-head concussion. That happened 4 weeks after my mother had a major stroke. And so, you know, here I'm trying to write a book, trying to maintain some vestiges of faith, trying to deal with all these situations. And in the book, I used an image of something that my son told me that happened to him at camp. He was at camp, and they were all playing this little game where girls would kind of stand in a huddle and take the hand of a boy and begin scratching his hand like this, gently, gently, gently. And pretty soon, it would have been a big scab, because it would have lost sensation. And I compared my controlling concept for that part of the book was that crisis is like that. It feels innocuous. It feels like you can handle it. And pretty soon you become so numb to it and you do not realize that you're being scraped away. Does that sound familiar to you in believing Mormonism? I think that's an image that you can probably identify with. But that sort of image speaks to people because it takes an experience that people can see or visualize and then they can say, you know, I know how that feels, even though nobody ever scratched my hand that way. Another thing you need to do when you're going to write is look around and think to yourself, what kind of writing speaks to you? What has been effective in your life? And I brought along, this is also something I've never done in public. When I started writing Latter-day Cipher, after I took the class in novel writing, and after I put myself through a course called the Marshall Plan for Novel Writing, which is a paperback book with a workbook. I mean, I was serious about doing this right. The book Silence of the Lambs is not one of my favorite books, but is one of the most well-written suspense books ever written. And I took it apart because I wanted to know what made it effective with points of view. Here in the back, I took each chapter and charted out from whose point of view it was being written. Now, I don't say you have to do that. What I'm telling you is, what kind of writing do you think is effective? What kind of writing would you like to do, not imitate, but emulate, so that you can be effective? Take it apart. Find out what made it effective. What made Thomas Harris's book effective? What's his plotting? And I took it apart to see the pacing of his plotting and the changes of point of view. And I think it helped me. So I brought that along to show you to do that. Another thing that is very, very effective, and I guess we're all, if you've read any of Dan Brown's books, he's really good at doing this, and that is to tease the reader. And by tease them, I mean get them interested in something so that they go along with you. The first inkling I ever had that I could write a novel, or my first desire to ever write a novel, was about 20 years ago, and I was reading a Mary Higgins Clark book. Any of you guys read Mary Higgins Clark? Let me read you this paragraph. And I read this in the car with my husband, and I laid the book down, and I said, you know what? If I could write like that, if I could ever achieve that kind of compelling, drawing a reader in, I'll want to write a novel. Listen to this and see if you don't agree with me. If her mind had not been on the case she won, Katie might not have taken the curve so fast, but the inner satisfaction of the guilty verdict was still absorbing her. It had been a close one. Roy O'Connor was one of the top defense attorneys in New Jersey. The defendant's confession had been suppressed by the court, a major blow for the prosecution. But still she'd managed to convince the jury that Teddy Copeland was the man who had viciously murdered 8-year-old Abigail Rawlings during the robbery. Miss Rawlings' sister, Margaret, was in court to hear the verdict and afterward had come up to Katie. You were wonderful, Mr. Mayo, she said. You look like a young college girl. What are you doing through this? You're saying, what about the curve? Why did she take the curve so fast? You know, in the first sentence, she has told you that this woman is about to take a curve too fast, and then she spends the next 3 or 4 pages telling you about the court case. And you want to, well, I wanted to not strangle her, but I wanted her to get to the point. Now, with reading a book, you can read ahead and that sort of thing, but it's very satisfying to a reader to have someone throw something out that compels their interest and then string you along for a while. It's not fraudulent to do that. It's actually very satisfying. Another thing that is very, very effective that a beginning writer can do, and that is to choose a phrase and either repeat the phrase or to do variations on the phrase. And I'm not going to read it because I think we're going to run out of time. But in the Mormon Mirage, let me back up. This book was first published in 1979. And then I was asked to rewrite it and update it, which I thought, oh, well, I can just bring all the footnotes up to date and, you know, a few changes in Mormon doctrine, and it will only take me 5 years, which it did. I thought I could do it, you know, in a series of months. But in the last chapter, I used the phrase, I was there and I believed. And I build tension with that phrase by saying, by starting in the last chapter with talking about meeting a young girl whose house parents at the Christian Children's Home there had asked me to speak to her. She was a Mormon. She had been raised as a foster child in a Mormon home and had been abused while she was there. And this girl was half Oriental and half Caucasian. And I told her as we were sitting down, I said, you know, I left the Mormon church when I was not too much older than you are, so I can kind of identify with that. But I said, if the Mormon church has changed so much. She said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, the changes in the blacks holding the priesthood, you know, the changes in the Book of Mormon. And she said, wait a minute, what do you mean blacks holding the priesthood? I said, well, you know, for many, many years, blacks were not able to hold a priesthood in the Mormon church. I said, you grew up in the Mormon church. She said, I never heard that. And I said to her, I was there. I believed. And I had major problems when changes like that happened. Well, I use that phrase, and so I'm urging you to consider a technique of using as your controlling concept a phrase. The image in the end of this is the Hosanna shout. Have any of you ever participated in the Hosanna shout? That's where you wave a white handkerchief in solemn assembly and shout Hosanna. Is it at the dedication of the temple? I think that's when I did that, yeah. And I use the imagery of the Hosanna shout now as a believer in Jesus Christ and not a believer in Mormonism, what that meant to me. Another thing that if you're going to write anything that's nonfiction or if you write fiction is to organize your thoughts. I've alluded to these 3x5 cards. Let me tell you how I write an article or a book of nonfiction. I start taking notes on 3x5 cards. Each source that I use, I assign a number. And this is a Reader's Digest condensed version of how to do this. But say this would be source number one. So I don't have to write it out every time I allude to it on my cards. This is source number two, and I keep a set of source cards in these. Then when I get ready to write an article or a book, I clear out an area in my house, sit down in the middle of the floor, and deal cards. And I let the book find the form of my material. And it's a very natural way to write. You can do that, because when you start writing something, things will be in clumps. There'll be, you know, different areas of things. You deal them out into the major clumps. Say there's three major areas of what you're going to be talking about or writing about. After you've got them in those three clumps, go through the clumps and make sure what's in each clump deserves to be in that pile. And then put that two of them aside and do the same thing until you've got your material organized. I wrote the entire Mormon Mirage in longhand in spiral notebooks, a pile of stock spiral notebooks off of 3x5 cards. And nobody's ever accused me of being disorganized in this book. They've accused me of other things, and not that. But that's just a freebie. The other thing, and Sue alluded to this, in writer circles we have an acronym, EIC. Anybody know what that stands for? Butt in chair. Everybody thinks that writing is done, you know, as you're walking through the woods and you're having inspiration and, you know, things are coming to you and you're watching movies or books, but the real writing doesn't happen until you sit down in a chair and put your fingers on a keyboard or on a pencil and make it happen. Now you think, oh, well, I know that. I am a professional writer. I've been writing and publishing for 35 years. Do you know what an enormous erosive effect the internet has had on my writing production? If it happens to me, and this is my job, and I have deadlines, then, you know, I know it must be happening to some of the rest of you. Turn off the browser, turn off the email, turn off Twitter, turn off Facebook, write. B-I-C, button share. Another thing that is very, very important, and when we're writing inflammatory or controversial things, this is not your first inclination to do this, but I want to urge you to do it, is join a critique group and let other people critique your writing. After we're through here today, if some of you guys want to stay over in a corner, we'll say this corner, you want to be in a critique group and you live in the same geographical area, critique each other's work. I compare critique groups and editors to someone who tells you that your fly is down or your slip is showing before you go out in public. That's the, and I cannot emphasize enough how important that is. Now you might think, well, I'll just get somebody to edit it. Did you know that a professional editor will charge you between $50 and $100 an hour to edit your work? Isn't it better in this economy to get together and somebody can say, you know, that's not working? You have to be committed to be honest with one another, and if somebody writes something and their purpose is to get you to think something or see something, if it doesn't work, you say to them kindly, you need to work on that. That doesn't work, you know. Here's some suggestions. And if you're all in it together, then it becomes more of a pleasure. Another thing you have to be willing to do if you're a writer is rewrite. The bane of the existence of every writer. And there's a sci-fi writer named C.J. Cherry. And she said, it's perfectly okay to write garbage as long as you edit brilliantly. So rewrite. Now, I wanted to spend just a few minutes telling you what's on this resource page that I gave you. On the top is my own website for my writings about Mormonism. I have posted this on the RFM board, but if any of you would like to contribute an item to my 365 Reasons Why I Won't Return to the Mormon Church, it can be your first published article. Some of you who are interested in the craft of writing novels or fiction, I blog with five other published, what are called upmarket fiction writers at Novel Matters. And then you're probably not interested in the theological thing, but it does explore the fact and representation. There's a place where you can find me. Here's a place for my book trailer. You guys know what a book trailer is? It's like a movie trailer, only it's about a book. And I'm a professionally produced book trailer of Latter-day Cypher. The books that I urge you to get are Writer's Market if you're going to try to market your writing. And the cool thing about Writer's Market now is that you can subscribe online for $6 a month and search. You don't have to go through a book, you know, thumbing through and turning down corners. You can search and it has a little, your page has the ability to store up the information of things you need for later. Elements of Style, I've already mentioned. The Marshall Plan for Novel Writing is what I use to plot my novel. And for any kind of writing, there's something called the Snowflake Method, and it's a very first, it starts out as visual, but then it's more concept-oriented to help you organize and be creative with your writing. And then the classic book, Writing Down the Bones, about exercise and inspiration, totally from a secular point of view, you will all approve. Useful sites for manuscript and proposal preparation. I chose these all from one site, and it is a site of a Christian Christian agent, but it's the best place I've ever seen where it succinctly tells you one thing after another what to do to prepare a proposal, what to do, how to write a query letter to an agent or to an editor, all the things you need to know to not make yourself look stupid. And the reason I say that is, here is a reality in the publishing world. If you blow it with a publishing company or an editor, you don't get a second chance. If they reject your manuscript, they keep logs of these things. You can't fix it up and send it back again. So don't do it right the first time. Because if you really wanted Simon & Schuster to publish your book, and you have a really good book, but you give them such a lousy query letter that they throw it out, you can't come back and write a better query letter. So learn to do it the first time. And then I provided for you list of writers' conferences. If you want to get the attention of an editor or an agent, the best place to do it is to sit next to them at a writers' conference. And they come there knowing that that's what you're going to do. You're not intruding. And writers' conferences are set up, at least the Christian ones. I haven't gone to any secular ones. They're set up so that as part of your fee, it's understood that there will be an agent at every table and that you can sit next to that agent and you can tell them your ideas and get some feedback. I mean, that's fantastic. So anyway, I've got your resources to find those kinds of things. I want to talk to you a little bit about memoir writing, and that's something I think Sue, one of the purposes she asked me to come. Remember as you're writing that your personal experience is not normative. What that means is that your experience is unique, individual, and though it may have commonalities with others, you can't expect others to have the same reactions to things that you did. I found this out when I wrote a book called Ex-Mormons, Why We Left. And I interviewed 8 people who had left the Mormon church. Sandra Tanner was one of them. And I asked them, what was your point of departure? Because see, mine was reading, looking at a woodcut. Another person's was hearing a radio program. Another person reached in their pocket and found a brochure that had been in a pocket since the fall before. Everybody's different. And so recognize that and acknowledge that. Acknowledge your readers as being someone that's not, you're not expecting to come to the same conclusions as you. I was going to read you, how much time do we have? When is this actually over? Does anybody know?
5:30.
15 more minutes.
I'd like to leave at least 10 minutes for questions.
Right, 10 minutes for questions. Okay. With memoir writing, I consulted someone who does that for a living, and she said that the first thing that people ask her when she goes and offers memoir, her books, which are memoirs of her own experience, people always want to know, how does your family feel about that? And for those of you who are going to write about your experiences leaving Mormonism and have Mormon family, that is the issue. And I'm going to give you her advice. You can take it or leave it, because this woman has done this. She says, first of all, don't overexpose others. She recommends that you put it before a critique group and see how they react before you do that. And she also said that in the case of your own failings, not the failings of others, or not things that need to be righted, but sometimes things need to be buried. If you've made a mistake and you've hurt only yourself, it may not be helpful to tell everybody. Another thing is she talks about don't whine. Now, how on basis can you get this? But if you show, don't tell, then you won't be whining. Another thing is don't overdo any jargon. For a Christian writer, don't overdo the Christian jargon. For someone who is on the RFM board all the time, don't talk about the FSM unless you identify what the FSM is. Another thing she said was be gentle and wise when you can. Another thing she said was when you're dealing with pathos or tragedy. She gave the example of a book called The Glass Castle by someone named Jeanette Walls. And she said her matter-of-fact telling allows the reader to be enraged on her behalf. Her matter-of-fact telling allows the reader to be enraged on her behalf. She said, stay focused on a single theme. Employ humor. Just think how much more fun this conference was because people joked and laughed at themselves when they were speaking. You know, nobody likes someone that just, you know, that's bombastic. Be real, admit your own failings. And also, I'll add to that, please remember that even though you may have left this behind, anything that you say to a Mormon is going to be regarded as a testimony. Anything that is based on feelings is going to be put on an equal plane with their own feelings. And so it is best if you find some way to document something. Otherwise, you're just having your feelings against my feelings. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, I won't belabor that. When I wrote The Mormon Mirage, I wanted to just say, I want to talk about the Book of Mormon. I want to talk about Progress Christ. They made me write the first chapter about my exit from Mormonism. I didn't want to do that. And I think many of you may have the same kind of wanting to just talk about the facts and not about yourself. I talked to Richard Packham. And if you are thinking about writing a memoir or something that talks about your experience in the Mormon Church and you do not want it published until after your death, and there are many people that feel this way, he said that a good way to do that is to write it in your will that a non-Mormon attorney has copies of what you want distributed after your death. Another way of doing that is having it on a website with a protected password that only the lawyer knows, that you don't want your TBM brother-in-law going in after you die and destroying all copies of what you labored to leave to your posterity to explain why you did what you did. People that will not listen to you now when you want to talk to them may listen to you when you're dead. So again, do the very best job you can Do the very best writing you can. It may be your only chance to really explain yourself. And also, electronic documents can't be shredded. I am going to you want 10 minutes for questions, huh? Can we have 5 minutes for questions? Well, we since it started late, didn't we? Okay. Let me talk to you about marketing your book. And when I'm saying marketing, I'm talking about selling your work to an agent or a publisher. And promotion is what you do later. Something happened in the publishing industry that happened to everything else in American business last fall. You know, when people lost their retirement accounts, the same thing happened in publishing companies. Their publishing companies laid off staff. They cut back budgets. It is a different world, is what I'm trying to tell you, in the last 13 months in the publishing industry. I am not certain that this book would have been published if I had offered it to someone today. Even though I've got publishing credits, even though I've got a reputation, you know, as a writer, I'm not sure that anybody would have taken a chance on a nonfiction writer with a fiction work. How much more at a disadvantage you all are who have not written if you want to publish. But I'm going to give you some hints about what you can do. One thing you can do if you want to write nonfiction is build up credits. If you have to give articles away, get them published somewhere, in newsletters, in magazines that don't pay or whatever, so that you can say, I have been published. Somebody who's an editor looked at this, decided it was worth publishing, and they did it. So start small, even if you have to give your work away, to build up publishing credits, if you have in mind being able to publish nonfiction from that point on. With fiction, that's not necessarily true, because with fiction, Jeffrey Deaver, how many of you read Jeffrey Deaver? He writes short stories. I love him. But he said, you know, a short story is not a mini novel. They're very, very different things, so the same thing doesn't apply. Here's some things that you need to do to market your book. The first thing is, if it's fiction, it has to be finished. You cannot market a work of fiction unless you're somebody really famous or have something really, really marketable about you personally, unless it's finished. And remember what I said, if you blow it with a publisher, you can't go back and do it. If you blow it with agents talk. I sat in a panel discussion of 6 different agents who are competing agents, right? But they all talk about this one weird guy that has threatened to kill them if they don't publish his manuscript. No, this is true. This is Christian publishers too. But I'm telling you, it's a smaller world. The publishing world has shrunk. And it has shrunk to such an extent is you have to do it right the first time. If you don't get anything else out of what I'm telling you, if you want to publish, you have to pay the price. The price is getting educated, taking classes, and doing it right so that you don't blow your chances. The second thing is, after you've decided what you're going to do, go to a bookstore and see who is publishing the kind of thing you want to publish. Why, you say, well, why not go to a library? That's what has been published. You want to know what is being published. That way you can know who to approach that publishes the kind of thing you are writing. Please remember that, again, unless you have something very extraordinary about yourself or your message, no publishing company is going to change their profile and stance to publish your book, which is unlike anything else they've ever published. Go to the publishers that publish the kind of things you write. Make a list of those publishers. If they have published something that is identical to what you have written, then you don't want to approach them. Are you flirting with copyright infringement, for instance? With that list of publishers that you are interested in, go to Writer's Market, find out their guidelines. Write to them and say, what do you require that someone submit to you in order to have you consider it for publication? You will find that with this shrinking world, that with the fact that publishers have less staff, they're depending more on agents. So it may be your best deal to go to writers' conferences and get to know agents and find out what they want, because many, many publishing companies will not consider a manuscript. It's not such an agent anyway. Educate yourself about how to prepare a manuscript. On that sheet that you have there, tells you how to prepare a manuscript. Don't ever correspond by snail mail with anybody in the publishing industry unless you include an SASC, self-addressed stamped envelope. Learn that and the other acronyms of the industry before you try to do that. Don't simultaneously submit to more than one publisher at a time unless they say they do that. Make all your correspondence short and snappy. And know the importance of grabbing the attention of the editor or the agent in the first paragraph. I once interviewed a woman who was the head editor at one of the largest publishing companies in the world. And she told me that once a month she hired people from her youth group at church to come to her office and stuff rejection slips into the pile of manuscripts that she had there. She'd buy pieces for them and pay them $5 an hour just to put the rejection slips in the SASC to send back. What does that tell you? That was 10 years ago and they were overwhelmed. They're even more overwhelmed now. So I don't want to discourage you, but do it right. You know, be punchy. Get the attention. Think about Mary Higgins Clark getting your attention in that first paragraph. Think about the writers you like that get your attention right away. We live in a Twitter world. People are not going to read 50 pages into your manuscript or whatever to find the point of what you're getting at. You have to make your point early. Now, I told you this is the way to get published. This is not the way I got published. And I will tell you how I got published because I'm going to be truthful. I was 25 years old, had a new baby. My husband and I were literally about to starve to death. I had a horrific surgical procedure, and I don't want to go into it. But anyway, I couldn't work. I had a small baby. My husband's boss had decided that the way to motivate an insurance salesman was to withhold his pay, and we literally were about to starve to death. And I was reading an author in a reading group that I really liked, and I found out that author, Joyce Landorf, was coming to Albuquerque. So the first outing that I had, other than going to church, was I got myself dressed up and went to the bookstore where this woman was. She was an enormously popular writer at that time, and this bookstore was crowded with people. But as soon as I walked into the bookstore, everybody left. And it was the bookstore owner and me and this woman. And I was so awkward and so shy that all I could do was blurt out to her that I would one day love to be as good a writer as she was, that I had, you know, was a writer and I wanted to return to my writing career. But I made her so uncomfortable that she started talking about the weather. And that's the truth. And this was 1976, and she said, "Yeah, how about that flood in Idaho?" And I said, "Yeah, I didn't hear about that." And she said, "Well, you know, that kind of made me ashamed that the Mormons jumped in and did more for the relief effort than the Christians did." And I said, "Oh, I used to be a Mormon." And she said to me, "Now, wait a minute, you said you're a writer and you used to be a Mormon. I have a publisher that would love to publish your book." Okay, so I got away from writing about Mormonism for years and years and years, and then writing these other books, writing the magazine articles and that sort of thing. And then my husband and I are listening to the Da Vinci Code on audio tape as we're driving along the road. And my husband said to me, "There are far more codes and cool things in Mormonism than there are in the Da Vinci Code." I said, "The Deseret Alphabet?" Okay, and I start thinking and thinking and thinking. And I start writing the Latter-day Cipher. And I approach a woman who had been my editor at Zondervan, then she became an agent. And it was a tough sell. I mean, even though I had a reputation as an established Christian writer, to get them to look at my novel, because I was not a novelist. So I go ahead and write this book. At the same time, I'm revising this book. You talk about going into cognitive dissonance, to go jump back into Mormonism where you haven't really thought about it that much for like 15 years. It was very emotionally taxing. In fact, never mind. But anyway, at the time I finished it, I send a proposal, and everything that I tell you to do, how to do this, you know, I did it myself. I didn't cut any corners. I wrote a proposal just exactly like what you've got there on the sheet, how to do it. And I sent it to my agent, and I finished this novel, and she called it the most ignored project she had ever represented. She said she took it to book conventions for 3 years, telling editors, "This is a really cool book that I have that I'd like to offer you." And everybody said, "Yeah, we'll read it," but nobody ever did. Well, I became very, very discouraged and frustrated because I had spent 5 years of my life doing these two books on a subject that was painful to me with absolutely no return, right? I had a friend that prayed, that he said, I'm going to pray that God will give you a result by October 31st. Well, the summer rocked on, and this was in the spring. I call my agent, nobody's called for that letter to decipher. I'm still working on the Mormon Mirage, getting the proposal ready, and I give it to her. And on October 31st, and as God is my witness, this is the truth, on October 31st at 4 o'clock, she called me and said, guess what, Lepain, the very first editor who's read Latter-day Cipher loves it, he's going to publish it, and he's Moody Publisher. Well, yay! I didn't even think about the October 31st part. She called me back an hour and a half later at 5:30 and said, you know Stan Gundry, the senior editor that's been at Zondervan for 40 years? She says, I've known him for 40 years, worked under him and with him. I've never before known him to call and ask for a project. But he called me just a few minutes ago and said, you know that Lepain Scott, she's your client, isn't she? You think she'd be willing to rewrite the Mormon Mirage? And she said, I have the proposal on my table. That all happened between 4 and 5:30 on October 31st. Now, is that the way to get published? Not without divine help. Thank you very much. Questions? We have questions. 9 minutes for questions.
Well, you can stay as long as you want.
Okay.
A lot of questions. Just a reminder that social hour is 6:30 and dinner right at 7:30 and they are at 50 to serve. It's going to be a good time.
Question?
Yes. Where did you say the writer was that you were talking to when you were 25?
Joyce Landorf was her name. And I think she's, well, she had a very serious accident and was in a coma for a long time. I think she's probably gone on by now. Any other questions? Yes.
Me?
Yes.
I've been enjoying the Strange Light show, man, for the last year. I've learned that there's a particular structure in the story structure, the curve of string.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a similar structure in novel writing?
No, there's not, because novels are of so many genres. And the Snowflake Method will give you one. Another method is called the Hero's Journey, and you can look that up. No, there is no particular structure. I read the book, The Novel Plan for Novel Writing, The Marshall Plan for Novel Writing, to learn how to plot a suspense novel. And this is the genre of this book is literary suspense. That's what it's called. You're welcome. Yes.
FSM, Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Yes.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome.
Is that the one that you said, the book that you...
Oh, yes. It's on your sheet there. Okay. It's on your sheet. The novel plan, no, the Marshall plan for novel writing. For writing a novel or something like that. You've got the sheet. And it's got a workbook. You tear the pages out. You decide what length of book you want. You want 100,000 words, you want 75,000 words, those are pretty standard, 50,000, any of those for the length of a novel. And you decide on the basis of how many pages it is, how many points of view you have, if your protagonist has a collaborator or a confidant, and it shows you how to mount the tension so that it is satisfying to the reader. It keeps you turning the page.
Mm-hmm. How much of yourself is in the novel when you write? I mean,
I'm not answering
that. A lot of writing.
Well, let's put it this way. A friend of ours invited us over for dinner after finishing this book and said, when I rang the doorbell and she opened the door, and she said, hello, Solana. Busted.
You described writing the notes on 3x5 cards and numbering them by the source, and then you deal them out.
Mm-hmm.
How do you determine how to deal them? I got lost right there.
According to subject matter. I'm sorry, I should have said that. Because the source is on there, you don't have to worry about it being disconnected from where you got the information, for instance, in a nonfiction book. But as you begin dealing these things into piles, you see that your book is gaining its structure right there. You realize your book is about this, and this, and this, and this. So everything that's about that, you deal with together unless there's a reason not to do that. Now, I did that with this talk. I actually took these cards and spread them all over bed. I didn't do it on the hotel floor, because I don't know about hotel floors. And I spread them out, and I said, well, this is here, and this is here. And I did part of it at home. And as I listened to the speakers today, I realized there were other things that I wanted to make sure that you all knew, because I didn't know what this audience was going to be like, you know, when I came. And as I talked to you, some of you, and listened to the other speakers, I modified what I was going to say. Yes.
So did you become a born-again Christian?
Yes, I did. But it was not an automatic thing.
How much time?
Well, it depends on whether or not you count when I was baptized or when I learned to trust God again.
Okay.
Baptized fairly soon, learned to trust God 10 years.
You say that you need to add something new to a subject field in order to publish. You can't just regurgitate what's enough. So how do you go about educating something that's already been written? Are you just doing Google searches to make sure that what you're about to write hasn't already been written?
You mean for the purposes of gaining an agent or an editor? Is that what you're saying? Or just starting out in the writing process?
Or writing it for the essay.
Write for yourself first. Write for yourself first. Find out what you want to say first. And that is the uniqueness, is what you bring to it. Because as I said, nobody's experience is normative. All of us came, even though we have in common, I would assume, all of us in this room, that we were once Mormons and we're not now. I bet we don't have much more in common other than our geography at this moment. You know, we're very, very different. And so your individuality is your first thing. And that's the thing that you should pursue. Why you think what you think, why you came to your conclusions, and why that's important for someone else to know.
Certainly for a memoir, but you're doing a nonfiction, for example?
Like with the Mormon Mirage? Are you talking about a book or a magazine article?
A book, if you wanted to pursue a certain field of it.
You either have to say what's already been said in a new way, or an updated way, or a more valuable way, or a more insightful way. Or you have to say something new that someone has not yet said, which might be your own story, for instance. If nobody's ever told your story, then that's something new. Did I answer your question?
To just find out what has been written.
Oh, go to a bookstore, and then go on Amazon and see what's available. And of course, we didn't have the ability to go on Amazon, but that's what I would do, is maybe Google a phrase or like ex-Mormon, for instance, and just do some research. Now, this takes time, you know. Be prepared to wade through a lot of stuff if you really want to get a comprehensive list or a comprehensive look. It's important to do. If you really want to market something, you can say to a publisher, I have examined these things, and here are things that are similar to what I'm writing. This is also in the resources I have on your sheet. Please go look up all those things, because in marketing to an agent or to an editor, they will ask you what is similar to this and what is your competition. And you have to be prepared to have given them that in your proposal. They don't come back and ask you that. You have to have it ahead of time. So please believe me, you've got a wealth of information on that one sheet about how to proceed.
Thank you.